Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, Pete Musto, and John Russell. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Scientists say Australia's Great Barrier Reef suffered its most severe coral bleaching event in March. Coral are small marine animals that live together and form large hard structures called reefs. Bleaching usually happens when ocean water gets too warm, causing corals to release the healthy algae living in their tissues. The process turns coral white and makes them sick, sometimes killing them. Reefs are critically important to the health of the ocean and all the life it holds. The latest finding about coral bleaching came from researchers at James Cook University in Queensland, Australia. The Great Barrier Reef covers about 348,000 square kilometers. It contains the world's largest collection of coral reefs and is home to thousands of different kinds of sea life. Researchers say the most recent coral bleaching event is the result of extremely hot temperatures in the area over the past few months. Terry Hughes is director of the ARC Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University. He told the Reuters news agency that February had the highest temperatures since 1900, when record-keeping began. "We saw record-breaking temperatures all along the length of the Great Barrier Reef. There wasn't a cool portion in the north or a cool portion in the south this time around," Hughes said. "The whole barrier reef was hot, so the bleaching we have seen this year is the most extensive so far." Hughes added that he is now almost sure that the reef cannot recover to what it looked like even 5 years ago, let alone 30 years ago. Hughes warned that if global warming activity continues at the present rate, the Great Barrier Reef faces the possibility of becoming completely destroyed. "We will have some sort of tropical ecosystem, but it won't look like coral reef. There might be more seaweed, more sponges, a lot less coral, but it will be a very different ecosystem." I'm Brian Lynn.
Call it a mobility system or a wheelchair. It can be seen at the Tokyo airport, moving on its own. It is helping with social distancing while fighting the spread of the coronavirus. It also helps older passengers and those who otherwise need assistance walking the last few steps to the boarding gate. The mobility system seats one person and runs on its own without hitting anything. It has a pre-programmed path of about 600 meters at Tokyo's Haneda International Airport. It was shown Monday by WHILL, the company behind the technology. WHILL Chief Executive Satoshi Tsuji said robotics and self-driving technology reduce the need for a human at the wheel. They are good for these times of living with coronavirus. We are developing our business in order to help restore a world where people can enjoy moving around with peace of mind, he told the Associated Press. The ride lasts several minutes. It travels from the security area to the boarding gate at a speed of 3.5 kilometers per hour. But many people hope the technology can help in other places, such as hospitals or parks. The technology uses sensors and cameras to see a clear path and avoid hitting those walking toward it. Tests have been carried out at several airports since last year, including John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York. The company hopes to put it in airports around the world. I'm Susan Shand.
Technology is increasingly being used to mobilize groups protesting police violence and racial inequality across the United States. Messaging applications, or apps, are one of the main tools helping demonstrators communicate in real time about where protests are happening. Other technology tools are being used to record violence by police or demonstrators and listen to police communications. Last weekend, Michelle Burris learned about a protest in downtown Washington, D.C. through a Facebook message from a friend. When her friend asked her to join the protest, she said she knew she had to go. Burris bought a face covering with the expression Black Lives Matter on it to wear to the demonstration. That expression has been the central message shared by people taking part in widespread protests in recent weeks following the death of George Floyd. Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died on May 25th after a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, kneeled on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. The incident was caught on video. Burris marched carrying a sign that read, "No justice, no peace." After the first protest ended, she pulled up details on Instagram for another demonstration nearby involving a long line of cars. "It was extremely powerful, not only Facebook, but Instagram," Burris told the Associated Press. "It was very easy to mobilize." Protesters are turning to secure messaging services like WhatsApp, Signal, and Telegram to share information. These apps can encrypt or change parts of a message to improve user privacy. These apps, along with others for listening to police communications and recording video, are growing in popularity. Experts say the most widely used apps are the ones that are easy to use and can reach large groups. Steve Jones is a media researcher who studies communication technology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He told the Associated Press that reaching as many people as possible is the number one criterion for which platform someone is going to use. The experts say this is why social media services like Twitter, Facebook, and Facebook-owned Instagram have become top tools for organizing and documenting mass protests. Steve Jones noted that 50 years ago, during America's civil rights protests, it was almost impossible to know what was going on during a protest. There was a lot of rumor, a lot of hearsay, he said. Now you can reach everyone almost instantaneously. Sarah Wildman said she used Instagram to find and document several protests she attended in Atlanta, Georgia. Wildman said she uses Instagram's live broadcasting service to find out what is happening during large protests. This is especially important when protesters in the back might not know what is happening at the front. Organizers are also using Telegram, an app that permits private messages to be sent to thousands of people at once. This makes it possible for information on protest areas and times, as well as where police are making arrests, to be shared across entire cities. One New York City Telegram channel for protests grew from just under 300 followers to nearly 2,500 followers last week. The ease of shooting and sharing video has also led to recordings of violence being shared with millions of people within moments. Smartphone video of the police incident involving George Floyd helped fuel the widespread anger that led to the protests. Apptopia is a company that records data on app use. It reports messaging apps offering encrypted communication, like Signal, are seeing an increase in downloads. Signal was downloaded 37,000 times last weekend in the U.S., the largest number since it launched in 2014. Apps like Police Scanner and 5O Police Scanner, which permit anyone to listen to live police communications, were downloaded 213,000 times over the weekend, Apptopia reported. The Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, said it had found evidence that some groups were using technology to try to harm the protest efforts. The ADL's Center on Extremism said recently that white supremacists had attempted to use Telegram to increase violence. The ADL said the efforts by white supremacists appeared to be aimed at using the protest environment to start a long-promised race war in America. They are extremely active online, urging other white supremacists to take full advantage of the moment, the ADL added. I'm Pete Musto.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby is a classic American story. It tells the sad tale of a mysterious rich man, Jay Gatsby, who loves Daisy Buchanan, a married woman. The Great Gatsby can teach you many lessons about the English language. Its many film versions can, too. Let's listen to a few words from the 2013 version of The Great Gatsby.
All the bright, precious things fade so fast. And they don't come back.
The last two words you heard are a phrasal verb, and that is what will be the subject of today's report. We will explain a little more about phrasal verbs, phrasal nouns, and speaking. Let's explore a few definitions and examples.
Phrasal verbs have two or more words. These words are usually a verb along with one or more short words, such as in, on, out, or back. Phrasal verbs have an idiomatic meaning. In other words, they have a meaning that is different from what the individual words might suggest. In The Great Gatsby, the phrasal verb come back means to return to a former good condition. Phrasal verbs can have a noun form, too. Let's call these phrasal nouns. Here is an example. Imagine you hear a person describe what they did yesterday. They might say,
I worked out yesterday.
Work out is a phrasal verb. It means to exercise. How would the statement change if the speaker used a phrasal noun instead?
I had a good workout yesterday.
Let's listen to the two examples again.
I worked out yesterday. I had a good workout yesterday.
Did you notice a difference? In the statement with the phrasal verb, the speaker stressed the second word of the phrasal verb, the word out. In the phrasal noun example, the speaker stressed the first part of the word, work. Listen again.
Worked out, workout. Think back to the beautiful words from The Great Gatsby.
All the bright, precious things fade so fast. And they don't come back.
Did you hear how the speaker said the phrasal verb come back? She put stress on the word back. Imagine how the sentence might change if the speaker used a phrasal noun instead.
All the bright, precious things fade so fast, and they don't make a comeback.
While this line is not as strong as the line that was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, it does give you an idea of how different phrasal verbs and phrasal nouns sound. The next time you are watching films or speaking with an American, try to listen for how they say phrasal verbs and phrasal nouns, then try to stress the words in the way that they do. With time and with practice, your speaking will become clearer to native speakers. We hope that you will come back to us for future Everyday Grammar stories, or perhaps we should say that Everyday Grammar will make a comeback. I'm John Russell.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Today, on our National Parks journey, we travel to the largest state in terms of land area, Alaska. Alaska is home to more national parks than any other state. It is also home to North America's tallest mountain, the 6,190-meter-high
Denali Peak. The peak gives the surrounding protected area its name. Welcome to Denali National Park in central Alaska. Denali's grounds cover more than 2.4 million hectares. Within the park are glaciers, clear rivers, peaceful forests, and wildlife such as wolves, moose, bears, and sheep. Denali National Park seems huge, yet only one road goes through the park. Hundreds of thousands of visitors travel down that road each year to experience the Alaskan wild.
Denali National Park was first established 100 years ago. At the time, the park and North America's tallest mountain were known by another name. Many Americans knew the famous peak as Mount McKinley. In the late 1800s, gold miners unofficially named the peak after William McKinley, the 25th U.S. president. At the time, McKinley was still a presidential candidate. McKinley himself never traveled anywhere near the mountain, but the name stuck. In Alaska, however, locals continued to call the mountain Denali. The word Denali means the high one for the Athabascan people, many of whom lived north of the mountain. The area became a national park on February 26, 1917. Its name was Mount McKinley National Park. Some naturalists disagreed with the naming decision. A debate continued for more than half a century, a sign of the area's long and complex history.
In 1975, Alaskan state officials asked the federal government to change the name to Denali to honor the native Alaskans. But congressional members from the state of Ohio, where McKinley was from, opposed and blocked the renaming efforts. In late 1980, weeks before his presidency ended, Jimmy Carter increased the size of the park from 800,000 hectares to 2.4 million hectares. The expanded park also took on a new name. It became the Denali National Park and Preserve. The naming debate, however, was not over. Although the park took the name of Denali, the mountain itself still remained Mount McKinley for another 35 years. In August 2015, former President Barack Obama officially changed the name from Mount McKinley to Denali. The announcement was made shortly before Obama traveled to Alaska. His visit was aimed at publicizing the effects of climate change in the state.
The animals living within Denali National Park are just as famous as its tallest peak. In fact, Denali was the first national park created in order to protect wildlife. The park is home to 39 kinds of mammals and over 160 kinds of birds. Many people come to Denali to see the park's largest mammals. Some moose here weigh well over 500 kilograms. More than 1,700 caribou live within the grounds. Doll sheep flock together on hillsides. Wolves are everywhere in the park. Denali is known as one of the best places to observe wolves in the wild. Giant grizzly bears can also be seen. They enjoy catching salmon and eating wild berries in the summer. Denali also protects the remains of a prehistoric ecosystem. In 2005, geologists discovered fossilized evidence of dinosaur tracks within Denali. Tests showed the fossil to be about 70 million years old. It was the first sign of dinosaurs in central Alaska. Since then, scientists have discovered more than 300 fossil sites. The fossils preserve evidence of other ancient creatures and many kinds of plants. With each discovery, a more complete picture of Denali's past comes to life.
Adventure-seeking travelers visit Denali to climb North America's tallest peak. The first successful climb to the very top happened on June 7, 1913, when four men reached the summit. Every year, more than 1,000 people try to reach Denali's summit. Only about half of them succeed. Climbing Denali is extremely difficult. Climbers face harsh conditions and extreme weather. Winds can blow at speeds of more than 160 kilometers an hour. They must use special equipment to travel along glacier ice and difficult terrain. The Kahiltna Glacier is the longest glacier here. Climbers know it as the starting point for summiting Denali. It sees some of the most extreme temperatures of any place on Earth. Most successful climbs take about 3 weeks. Several local businesses offer group climbs.
Visitors can enjoy Denali in more restful ways, too. Many people travel by bus along the park's single road. Travel companies offer half-day bus tours. Others choose to ride bicycles along the long road. This gives them a chance to get up close to Denali's wildlife and peaceful environment. The park operates 6 campsites and offers several kilometers of trails. Denali is also home to a group of sled dogs. These Alaskan huskies are an important part of the park experience. Visitors can watch sled dog demonstrations in the summer to learn about this traditional Alaskan way of travel.
The park's past, present and future connect many different cultures and people across time.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.